Hey, you guys, happy Labor Day weekend, the end of, if you will, of the official summer season, though no one told the weatherman that because it's pretty warm out there. But good to be together as we continue our worship time. We've tried to worship with in song, worship in prayer, worship in acknowledging what God is doing in the lives of people, in your lives, connecting you with each other is part of our worship experience. Thank you, Molly, for telling us about what's going to go on in Belfast at Queen's University. And, you know, student ministry is a challenge these days worldwide for all of the issues. And Belfast has some additional challenges because of the history of that nation and the history of that part of Ireland, which is still part of the UK. We're just, as we worship together, we want to worship also in God's Word. So that's what we're here for. And we are finishing up today a series that we've been doing for the last 4 or 5 weeks called Life in Babylon. And the reason we're doing this is because there was that sense in the last several years of all the change, the cataclysmic change, the tsunami of change, the earthquake of change that's been happening in the culture. And we begin wondering, man, what is going on here? It feels so awkward and so hard. And how do we live in that? And in this whole deal, we ask the question, how do we live in Babylon? And really the answer is a couple of things. One is, do you just simply buy into the culture? Do you get absorbed into the culture? Do you give up your values and buy a whole other set of values? Do we just buy into the culture because we don't want to be at odds with the culture? We don't want to fight with the culture. We don't want to be set apart. We don't want to be called anything inappropriate. And so you think, we just buy into the culture. Or the opposite would be this, you become a separatist. And that's really a typical thing or fairly common in the religious world is people become separatists or isolationists or become hyperly religious and become kind of an isolated group over on the extreme. And that's the temptation. But I think as we looked at how to live in Babylon, we've looked at the lives of several people who lived through Babylon and how did they handle it. And so I think what was really kind of helpful is the fact that we looked at Daniel first, guy who grew up or was born in Jerusalem and then was taken captive and taken to Babylon. And how did he do it with all the influence that he eventually wielded? And he did it with tremendous integrity, a godly integrity. And I think it's very instructional for us today. Secondly, we looked at Jeremiah, who actually never went to Babylon, but he was a prophet back in Judah, in Jerusalem, but he kept instructing them how to handle this situation. And he did it by offering hope. It's interesting because Jeremiah, we call him the weeping prophet. He's the one who wrote Lamentations. He was lamenting. He was feeling the depth of the grief of his nation being destroyed and having walked away from God. But what he offered was hope. I know the plans I have for you, said God. Plans for you, for a future and for a hope. That's what he offered. I think maybe we could be that way too. And Nehemiah, we looked at, he was at the opposite end of the exile. And Nehemiah, and all that God used him in rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem, that he brought to the table a godly wisdom about how to handle it. Rather than just being angry at the world. Isn't that kind of, sometimes I think we as, the Christian world looks like it's just angry. Well, here people brought integrity and hope, and Nehemiah brought wisdom. And then last week we looked at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or my shack, your shack, and a bungalow is what I really like. It's my favorite. You know, as a kid I heard that, and I was like, yeah, I like it. But they brought a godly courage. Remember they were thrown into a furnace? And they said, my God will save me, and even if he doesn't, I'm still going to worship my God. They had amazing courage. So here's kind of the timeline, if you will, the chronology of the Old Testament. This is right near the end of the Old Testament, right before the 400 silent years, right when when God didn't send any more prophets. The next prophet he would send would be a guy named John the Baptist as a prophet announcing the coming of Christ, right? So right before that was this exile and this time of rebuilding. Though Israel never gained its prominence and its luster like it had before, it was kind of a second-rate nation, to be honest with you, during this time. And if we expand that a little bit, here we see Daniel and Jeremiah early in the time of the exile. We see Nehemiah and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the middle of it. And then we also find Ezra and Nehemiah at the end. But today we're going to look at a person named Esther, one of the most amazing women in all of history. She's incredible. And so we're going to ask this question. How did Esther navigate living in Babylon? And really even extended Babylon, because she's living in Persia, in modern-day Iran. And so how did she navigate it? How did she handle it? So we want to ask the question, too, how do we navigate living in a post-Christian culture that's going through profound and radical change? How do we do it? What is it in Esther's life that we might be able to learn from about how to handle that? So let's just kind of throw her name up there. Big as life, Esther. This is who we're going to talk about today, okay? Now, let me just give you a little bit about her. Esther, that is her Persian name. And in Persian, it means star, okay? And they would even refer to Venus with it, but it meant star. And so when she became queen, her name became Esther to hide her Jewish identity, okay? So they called her Esther, a star. Her real name is Hadashah. It's a Hebrew name. It means myrtle. Which we've had people named Myrtle, not very many anymore, but my grandparents' era, there were a lot of people named Myrtle. And Myrtle means this. It comes from the myrtle tree, which is associated with several things, with peace and love, with prosperity, with justice. And I think in this particular case, it's identified with the idea of survival. And we'll see that just here in a minute. But her name is Hadashah, meaning myrtle. Now, here's a picture of a myrtle tree. It's a beautiful tree. We have them here, crepe myrtles, right? They're beautiful. And this is Esther right here. So when you picture Esther, picture this. This is actually a myrtle tree in Israel. This is a beautiful, beautiful tree. Now, if you take those names, star and myrtle, in a sense, what you kind of come up with is she was a superstar. I mean, this woman is a superstar. But not just a superstar, she's a superstar for righteousness. This is a woman who stood up as someone incredible. You know, one of the words you could use for Esther is the word meek. But sometimes we think, well, meek's such a weak word. But actually, meek means power under control. And in some ways, that's her. But I think better than that, you could take superstar for righteousness and you really change it into this word. She's a champion. She is a champion. Now, here's what champion means. We usually think of a champion. In fact, I was just watching a video yesterday. I forget exactly what it was, but Michael Phelps, I think, has 21 or 23 gold medals. You know, I mean, it's like most in Olympic history by far. But he's a champion. And we usually think of that being a champion. But here's the real meaning of a champion. It is someone who tenaciously fights for a cause or on behalf of others who are endangered. A champion is someone who fights for others, not for himself, not for themselves. And they represent other people. I am going to defend you, is what a champion is. And I think that is the perfect description of Esther. Okay? So Esther, let's go back. Big as life. Look at that. Now, you guys, real quickly, let's just draw a line. This is one of the greatest stories ever. You know, like every great story, there are a couple of things. One is there usually is a protagonist in a story. Any great story, you read them, they have a protagonist. And that's an advocate or a champion of a particular cause or idea. It's kind of the hero, if you will, of the story. But when you have a protagonist, you always have an antagonist. That's the adversary who is actively hostile to someone or something. And in the story of Esther, we have those. Now, let's just put it this way. She became queen under a guy named King Ahasuerus. Now, King Ahasuerus had another queen named Vashti, and we'll find out here in a minute. He got tired of her and kicked her out. Now, we know him sometimes in history as Xerxes or Artaxerxes. Those are some of the names we use for him. And it's part of an entire empire during roughly 480 to 470 BC, okay? Now, the protagonist in this story is Esther. It's her, she and her cousin slash caretaker, Mordecai. They are the champions and the advocates for what is right. She is a champion for righteousness. But the antagonist in this story is a guy named Haman. And Haman is an Agagite, and he's the highest advisor to the king. The king's kind of a non-player here, to be honest with you. It's really from Esther and Haman. And what's going on, the conflict between them, is no small conflict. Okay? Here it is. It is literally for their survival versus the genocide of every Jew living in the Persian Empire. There's a plan that they make to kill every one of them on the same hour, the same day of the same month. Every Jew is going to be murdered. That's the plan. And God raises up Esther to do something about it. Now, let me just put it in a map for you real quickly. Here's a map of the Persian Empire. Let's add them real quickly. Over on the left, we have Judah. We have Israel. Then we have Babylon. That's where we find Daniel, Jeremiah. That's what's going on in Babylon. And then eventually the Persians take over and they rule from Susa, which is in Iran. It's there over on the right. Now, let's put it in a modern day map just so you can see where it's all at. Here we have Jerusalem and Judah on the left. We have Babylon. It's in modern day Iraq, just 55 miles south of modern day Baghdad. And then we have the Persian Winter Palace in Susa in modern day Iran. This is where it is all happening. Now, you guys, let me tell you the story of Esther, okay? It's going to take about 10 minutes to tell you this story. Like other figures, you can kind of piecemeal it out of the books. Nehemiah, others, you can piecemeal it. Esther, you kind of have to understand the whole thing, the whole story, from beginning to end to really understand it. It's going to take 10 minutes to do this, and I found what I thought would be a more effective way than me doing it. Especially with us having some of the younger people in the room today, which we're really glad. I thought maybe this is a more creative way to do it. There's a group out there called the Bible Project. And they outline, kind of creatively present different books of the Bible, and they have one on Esther. So I'm going to ask them to present the book of Esther to us, okay? And then I'll come back up and wrap it up. So let's enjoy Esther.
The Book of Esther, it's one of the more exciting and curious books in the Bible. The story is set over 100 years after the Babylonian exile of the Israelites from their land. And while some Jews did return to Jerusalem, remember Ezra and Nehemiah, many did not. And so the Book of Esther is about a Jewish community living in Susa, the capital city of the ancient Persian Empire. The main characters in this story are two Jews, Mordecai, and then his niece Esther. And then there's the king of Persia, who's something of a drunken pushover in this story. And then there's the Persian official Haman, the cunning villain. Now, this is a curious book in the Bible, mainly for the fact that God is never even mentioned, not once. Which might strike you as kind of odd. I mean, isn't the Bible about God? But this is a brilliant technique by the author, who's anonymous, by the way. It's an invitation to read this story looking for God's activity, and there are signs of it everywhere. The story is full of very odd, quote, coincidences and ironic reversals, and it all forces you to see God's purpose at work, but behind the scenes. Let's just dive into the story. The book opens with the king of Persia throwing two elaborate banquets that last a total of 187 days, and it's all for the grandiose purpose of displaying his greatness and splendor. On the last day of the banquet feast, he's really drunk, and he demands that his wife, Queen Vashti, appear at the party to show off her beauty. She refuses, and so in a drunken rage, the king deposes Vashti and makes the silly decree that all Persian men should now be the masters of their own homes. Then he holds a beauty pageant because he wants to find a new queen. This is like a really bad soap opera. But it's right here that we're introduced to Esther and Mordecai. Esther hides her Jewish identity and enters the beauty pageant and wins. And the king is so obsessed with Esther that he elevates her to become the new queen of Persia. Now after this, and even more serendipitous, is the fact that Mordecai just happens to overhear two royal guards plotting to murder the king. And so he informs Esther, who in turn informs the king, and Mordecai gets credit for saving the king's life. Now right here from the beginning, God's not mentioned anywhere, but this all seems providentially ordered. What is it that God's up to? You have to keep reading. We're next introduced to Haman, who's not actually a Persian. He's called an Agagite. He's a descendant of the ancient Canaanites. Remember 1 Samuel chapter 15. The king elevates Haman to the highest position in the kingdom, and he demands that everybody kneel before Haman. Well, when Mordecai sees Haman, he refuses to kneel, which of course fills Haman with rage. And when he finds out that Mordecai's Jewish, Haman successfully persuades the king to enact this crazy decree to destroy all of the Jewish people. And to decide the date of the Jews' annihilation, Haman rolls the dice. A die is called pur in Hebrew. Tuck that away for later. 11 months later, on the 13th of Adar, all the Jews will die. Haman and the king then have a drinking banquet to celebrate their really horrible decision. So the focus now turns to Mordecai and Esther, who are the only hope for the Jewish people. They make a plan that Esther is going to reveal her Jewish identity to the king and ask him to reverse the decree. But approaching the king without a royal request is, according to Persian law, an act worthy of death. So in a key statement, Mordecai, he's confident that even if Esther remains silent, that deliverance for the Jews will arrive from another place. And then Mordecai wonders aloud. He says, who knows? Maybe you've become queen for this very moment. Esther responds with bravery, and she purposes to go to the king with her amazing words, if I perish, I perish. Now, in what unfolds, we watch the ironic reversal of all of Haman's evil plans. So Esther hosts the king and Haman at a first banquet, and she says that she wants to make a special request of both of them at an exclusive banquet the following day. So Haman leaves the banquet totally drunk, and he sees Mordecai in the street. He fumes with anger, and he orders that a tall stake be built so that Mordecai can be impaled upon it in the morning. It seems like things can't get any worse for the Jews and for Mordecai. But all of a sudden, the story pivots. It just so happens that night, the king, he can't sleep. And he has the royal chronicles read to him for good bedtime reading. And he just happens to hear about how Mordecai had saved the king's life. He had totally forgotten. So in the morning, Haman enters to request Mordecai's execution. And the king in that moment orders Haman to honor Mordecai publicly for saving his life. So now Haman has to lead Mordecai around the city on a royal horse, telling everyone to praise him. Now this moment in the story, it's a pivot for the whole book. It begins Haman's downfall and Mordecai's rise to power. Watch how this works. The day after is Esther's second banquet. So the king and Haman arrive, and Esther informs the king that first of all, she's Jewish, and second, that Haman has enacted a decree to murder her, and to murder Mordecai, who saved his life, and to murder all of the Jews. Now the king's had a lot to drink, so when he hears this news, he goes into yet one more drunken rage, and he orders that Haman be impaled on the very stake he made for Mordecai. It's ironic and a grisly way for Haman to go. Haman's execution, however, doesn't solve the problem of the decree to kill all of the Jews. So the focus now turns to Esther and Mordecai as they make a plan to reverse the decree. They discover that the king can't revoke a decree that he's already made. So instead, the king commissions Mordecai to issue a counter-decree. On the appointed day that all of the Jews were supposed to be killed, the 13th of Adar, now the Jews are ordered to defend themselves and to destroy any who plotted to kill them. Then Mordecai, Esther, and Jews everywhere hold banquets and feasts to celebrate this new decree, and Mordecai is elevated to a seat beside the king. Eventually, the decreed day comes, and the Jews triumph over their enemies. First, they destroy Haman's family, and then any other Persian officials who had joined in Haman's plot. And then on a second day, they get permission to destroy any who plotted against them throughout the entire kingdom. This results in joy and celebration as the Jews are rescued from annihilation. The story then tells about how Esther and Mordecai established by decree this annual two-day feast of Purim, to commemorate their deliverance from destruction. And the name of the feast comes from Haman's dice. Remember, Purim. The book concludes with a short epilogue as Mordecai is elevated to second in command in the kingdom, and we are told now of his royal greatness and splendor as the Jews thrive in exile. Now, step back. Notice how this whole story has been designed. The story was full of moments of ironic reversal, but we can now see the whole story is structured as an ironic reversal, right down to the details. So the king's splendor and feasts and decrees are mirrored by Mordecai's splendor and feasts and decrees at the end. Esther and Mordecai, they first saved the king, but now in the end they save all of the Jews. Then you have Haman's elevation and edicts and banquet that gets reversed by Mordecai's elevation and edict and banquet. And then at the center you have Esther and Mordecai's planning scenes, and then Esther's two banquets that act as a frame around the greatest moment of reversal in the whole story, Haman's humiliation and Mordecai's exaltation. Beautiful. Another fascinating feature of this book is the moral ambiguity of the characters. There's a lot of drinking and anger and sex and murder, of which Mordecai and Esther are a part. Not to mention their violation of many commands in the Torah, like marrying Gentiles or eating impure foods. And so the story's not putting Mordecai and Esther forward as moral examples, as if it endorses all of their behavior. But they are put forward as models of trust and hope when things get really bad. And so the book of Esther comes back to that question with which we began, why God is not mentioned. The message of this book seems to be that when God seems absent, when his people are in exile, when they're unfaithful to the Torah, does this mean that God is done with Israel? Has God abandoned his promises? And the book of Esther says, no. It invites us to see that God can and does work in the real mess and moral ambiguity of human history, and he uses the faithfulness of even morally compromised people to accomplish his purposes. And so the book of Esther asks us to be willing to trust God's providence even when we can't see it working, and to hope that no matter how bad things get, God is committed to redeeming his world. And that's what the book of Esther is all about.
All right, Esther in 10 minutes. But it helps to see it, doesn't it? It's like, oh man, I get it now. And it's written so beautifully and so balanced with this incredible pivot point right in the middle. So I think we have to go back then and ask ourselves the question, how did Esther navigate living in Babylon? How did she do it? She wasn't perfect. I don't know about you, but I identify with that. You know, if I had to be perfect for God to somehow work in my life or work through me, I'd have to quit tomorrow. I'd have to quit today. Maybe I'm done right now. But God uses people. And in this particular situation, how did he use her? He used her as a champion. Someone who would tenaciously fight for her countrymen that were endangered. And she stepped up. You know, she actually didn't really want to. When Mordecai said, why don't you go to the king? She said, do you understand? He hasn't called me into his office in 30 days. And that's usually how much time you need in order to be invited. If I go, he'll kill me. And Mordecai said, well, maybe for such a time as this is why he made you queen. And if you don't go, then God will use somebody else. But he said, maybe you could. And she finally says, if I die, I die. If I perish, I perish. Wow. She decided to be a champion, to stand up for what was right, what was good, what God had called her to, what God had called for her people. So we ask the question, how can we navigate living in a post-Christian culture that's going through such profound and radical change? How could we do it? Let me give a long answer real quickly, okay? The long answer is this. Trusting that God's fingerprints can and will be all over our circumstances if we obediently open our hearts and our eyes to his guidance, his sovereignty, his providence. His sovereignty means that God gets to do whatever he wants to do because he is God and he will do it. And providence are the specific things that he does. He acts in very unique ways. Because he has that right, because he's God. And that we can trust him that his fingerprints will be all over the situation. Wow. So let me just maybe put it in a short term. I think it means this. How can we navigate living in this world? It's by being a champion. We'll be God's champion for his plan, for his purpose, for his people. He'll ask us to be a champion. I don't know if you feel like a champion. But that is what the Spirit of God does in the heart of a human being, is he makes us champions. So I have this question. For such a time as this, today, September 2023, for such a time as this, God has raised you up and placed you in a certain place and for a certain reason. God has raised you up. He created you. Just think about of all history. He chose this time for you to be alive. You know, if you ever thought about wanting to be a part of another time in history, if you could have been born in another time, you know, for me, it's colonial America. I would love to have been born in colonial America and go through all that that was all about. But he didn't choose that time for me. He chose this time for me. He chose this time for you. And so there's really three questions. Where is it that God has called you to? Where? Where has God called you for such a time as this? No matter what, where is it? Now, in some ways, you have to assume it's St. Louis, Missouri right now. It's where you live. Now, maybe he's calling you somewhere else at some point, but where is it? And maybe more importantly, is it, what is it? What is it that he's raised you up for? Because there are no superstars in a sense. There are only people who are willing to be champions. And that's every person. What is it for you? Maybe most importantly, here's another question. Are you willing? Are you willing? At first, Esther didn't want to do it. She was a pretty normal human being. She said, do you understand this might cost me my life? They might kill me for this. She didn't want to do it. But she probably gave it some thought, and the Lord worked in her life, and she said, okay, I'll do it. If I die, I die. She didn't know if she'd make it through. The real question for all of us is, are we willing? Are we willing to do what God has made us for in order to make an impact? You guys, I'm just going to take a few minutes just to share personally maybe something that I saw. So for many of you, if you didn't know, a week ago this morning, my mom passed away. So Diane and I are really grateful that we got to be there. We made it on Friday night, and we got to see her Saturday. She was not very interactive during that day, and then early Sunday morning, she passed. But about 45 minutes before she passed away, there was this gal. There were two nurses that were amazing, just amazing in hospice. One was a younger gal adopted from South Korea by a family in Kearney, Nebraska. Kind of makes me laugh. Like, okay, a Korean gal in Kearney, Nebraska. Have you ever been to Kearney? It's not very Korean, just so you know. I've been there. And she was just an incredible delight. Smart, sensitive, knowledgeable, personal, connecting, amazing. She brought her 9-month-old son into the room one day just to be with us because she wanted to share her life, and we wanted to share our lives with her. And then there was another nurse, about probably 60-year-old gal, who grew up in West Germany. And so she grew up before the wall came down, so she grew up in West Germany, and had been working in this hospice group for 30 years. And she came in before her shift on Sunday morning and just to check on my mom. And there was my sister and myself and Diane and my sister's husband. And she said, you know what I would suggest is that maybe each one of you take 10 minutes just to be with her alone. And she said, in her very straightforward German fashion, she said, you know, sometimes you just have to wrap up things and tie up loose ends. And I'd encourage you all to take some time to do that. And, you know, it made sense, right? And so we kind of all looked at each other and said, what do you think? And we all said, yeah, let's do that. And then I looked at my sister and said, would you like to go first? And she said, yeah, sure, but I don't think 10 minutes is going to do it. And I kind of knew that in my soul, in my heart. And so I said, whatever you need. And so she took the first shift. And so this nurse had told us many times she had seen, I think specifically four times she had seen, that when people kind of tied up loose ends, that then the person had been set free to pass. And we didn't know if that would happen. So my sister went first. And Diane and I went downstairs to have breakfast. My sister's husband left the room and went somewhere else. It was just the two of them. And they spent about 20, 25 minutes together. I don't know exactly what was said, but I think what was offered was forgiveness and to be forgiven. My sister finished. She needed to go to the restroom. She left the room. The nurse came in, and my mom passed with no family there. I almost wanted to say, really, Mom? You know, I've been here all night with you. All night I sat here with you. I talked to you all night. And we settled our peace. But she said that's not uncommon either, for them to maybe not want to do it in front of their family, to spare them that. And my sister came back in, and she was just undone. But I think what I was undone by was the fact that God had used this German lady, Uta, to very instructionally help us say goodbye, to wrap up loose ends, tie them up, settle everything. And it happened just like that. Afterwards, I saw Uta, and I said, you know, I don't know if you're an angel or a prophet. And she said, I'm neither. I'm simply a child of God. And I thought, wow. Here's this woman who's been working in this hospice environment for 30 years. And she just has allowed God to use her for such a time as this to be redemptive. It was one of the most redemptive things I've ever seen. That especially for my mom and my sister. And it made the whole thing worth it. As ugly as it was, it made it all worth it. To see God's kindness expressed and guided by the hands of a woman who was willing to step into it with who she was and what God had shown her. Just this really cool believer who just was part of it with us. I was absolutely amazed. She's kind of an Esther. For such a time as this, Uta became a guide for my family. I wonder, we all have different skills and different abilities, different things we bring to the table. But the real question is, are we willing? Are we willing to let God use us as a champion? To champion the needs and the hearts of other people as they navigate life? And maybe even navigate death. So the real question here is, where is it? What is it? Are you willing? So here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to take just a couple of minutes and think it through. As we wrap this series up about living in Babylon, this amazing story of Esther, that she stepped forward to be a champion, and what would it guide us to do, that God would use us as a champion in the world today? So would you just take a minute right where you're at, in the quiet of this room, to ask him those questions? And if you're willing, just tell him you're willing. And when you say you're willing, he'll guide you, right? That's what he does. That's what the Holy Spirit does. He guides you. So think it through. Where, what, are you willing? So let's pray. Father, we marvel. We marvel at the beauty of the life of Esther, of her cousin Mordecai, of the anger of Haman, of the weakness of the king. But you raised her up for a purpose. You raised her up for your people. Father, you created every one of us for a reason. You placed us in a place. You gave us skills and abilities, a heart, passions. And just like Esther, we're resistant. We're hesitant. And yet she stepped forward as a champion. Father, listen to the hearts of your people. Father, speak to each one of us right here, right now. Father, we will lift up our hands to you. We will praise you with our lips, because you are the one who loves us with a steadfast love. A steadfast love that never goes away. It is unconditional, it is powerful, it is with us every day. And there's so much to life that's hard and pulls us down and pulls us sideways, and it tears us even apart. But Father, nothing in this world will offer us anything of satisfaction except for you yourself. It's because your steadfast love is greater and better than life itself. We will praise you. We'll give you our hearts. We'll trust you just like Esther did. Even when she was hesitant, we will trust you and say, use it as you can. And if I die, I die. But we'll stand for you. We'll love you. Father, you did it in her life. You did it in the lives of so many people throughout history. But you will do it again. You'll do it again. And you'll do it in us. And it's to you that we give our praise.